This is CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. That was Ship It Out by Sukin Lee and Adam Litovitz off of their new Juge 2 album on Mint Records. Sukin Lee is in Montreal this coming Friday at the Diving Bell Social Club on the bill with Johnny Void and Benjamin Camino. I recently sat down with Sukin in a Zoom call and we had an epic conversation about many things. Her storied broadcasting career, her work in music, and her work in film. I want to shout out, before we get into it, I want to shout out Jesse Locke and Zine Obscura Issue 7, who have recently published an excellent long-form interview with Sukin Lee, as well as a flexi disc of archival recording that Sukin made in the very early 90s. I want to thank Sukin for taking the time to speak to us. It was a fascinating conversation. Let's listen. So I want to start with media. I've been watching clips of you on Much, and I wanted to ask you about that media form. It was unique then. It stands out now. It was so kinetic. Everything's moving. The camera's moving. You're moving. Maybe you could talk about that time in media and making media that looked like that.
Yeah, it was radical live unscripted television. Yeah, it was very, very exciting. When Moses Neimer, who was the guy who dreamed up the whole sort of City TV Much Music empire, reached out to me to give me the job, I was like, okay, if you're looking for a telegenic model who will read script that somebody wrote, that's not me. Mm-hmm. And he's like, that's not what I want. I really don't want that. And that was so true. He was really into Marshall McLuhan, the idea of the medium is, oh, thank you so much.
Coffee delivered.
the important. Medium, yeah, very, very important. The medium is the message, the idea of sort of revealing process rather than having the final outcome. His belief was destroy the studio. Back then, like studios were such where the sound person was in their tiny little room, the studio was there, and then everyone was separated and compartmentalized in various tiers and also physical areas. His idea was strip all that stuff, break it down so it's more of a living organism. He really loved the idea of seeing process as key. He wasn't a bean counter, really was not interested in ratings. He's like, fuck ratings. Like, who does that now? Everybody lives and dies by ratings. Ratings can be whatever. They're not the be. Ratings dictate a kind of programming. And sometimes that's not good. Sometimes it's okay. But regardless, he was radical in that he was like, I don't care about ratings. Shut up about ratings. He just wanted to see something interesting and also reveal the process of the making. So the idea of throwing somebody on the air who had never been on television before was very exciting to him. Harold Hussein, his head meteorologist, was a taxi driver that happened to give Moses a lift, who demonstrated an incredible understanding of the weather and went on to become the head meteorologist of City TV. So he really loved casting in this way, and he came across my work. So I would say Much Music, under his leadership, was a space that anything could happen. Like, we were like, I think, 29 on the dial. There were hours to fill. It would be like, okay, Sukin, you're up. And it was a really wonderful kind of almost like a sports team where I would be in, the VCR operator would have to be in sync with the camera operators. They're always good to have a laugh and try whatever. Like, there was just so much time to fill that I would do with the most ridiculous things, like I'd go, okay, so can I have a slow zoom into my armpit? Done. To me, I was coming from Vancouver with a background of filmmaking and music and performance art. And I had been a TV addict as a kid, but became very disinterested in TV and kind of anti-television in my teen years, really hated TV, and found life way more interesting. I left home when I was 15 and I found a group of very dynamic artists at that point when Vancouver was still it was cheap to live in. There were lots of great crossovers between poets and writers and artists and musicians, all sort of collaborating. And so, I was able to sort of, I had been there for a while. And then when he offered me the job, I was like, okay, this will be the new medium that I communicate in. Return to television. And this will be fun. So I sort of took it on as in the spirit of a performance artist, which was great because it sort of, it was really unique because anything could happen and did. Everything from the most boring, shitty moments to really ridiculous experiments, John Spencer Blues Explosion, like running through the front wind and running down the window and running down Queen Street.
Sorry to interrupt. I remember that both at the time and I rewatched it in running up to this interview. And one of the things that's hilarious about it is, which I didn't really pick up on as a kid, is that at a certain point, it's clear that no one knows what's going on. You're saying, are we going to watch the video now? The band doesn't know. It seems like producer off air, whoever off air doesn't really know. It's, no one knows what's going on. It's amazing.
No one knows what's going on then. He's running out the front window down the street, never to return.
Yeah.
You know, and those kinds of moments, so exciting, you know, mm-hmm. so exciting. There was also a culture that Moses was very much about, like, reflecting the community. And that meant, you know, having Speaker's Corner, which was like a camera that people would go in and talk and put in a loony in and speak. And during the Christmas parties at Mush Music, they would show the raw X-rated Speaker's Corner. And they'd be like, whoa, Barb. That also meant, you know, you can see it online, like City TV everywhere. There'd be like bumpers going into like gambling dens in Chinatown. How the hell did you get in there? Yeah. City TV everywhere. A kid like smelling an apple in Little India. You know, and same with Mush Music. It was the window. You want to come down to Mush Music, come down here and be a part, hang out. I spent so much time hanging out in the window, like with Mary the hot dog lady, and just... So many people have said, I came down to Queen Street and you hung out with me, Sukyin, and like just hours of stuff of doing that. And then also interesting to me as an artist, the kind of radical sort of experimentalism that could happen, that could take place in such a format, doing experiments where like I would lie down pretending I was dead on Queen Street to see what would happen. People would walk over me. You know, and it was my friends at, you know, in the station where, okay, Tony, set up the camera across the street, angle it down her lying on the sidewalk. You know, half of the stuff, it was like gone in a second. Like as soon as we did, it was like gone. It's, you know, halfway to Mars. So there was really no attachment to anything, but it surprises me to this day. People still remember. They're like, recognize me. And they're like, yeah, you showed us how to relieve trap gas. Butt in the air or, you know, that's not, I mean, that's, and then there's a whole legion of interesting thinkers and cultural makers and, you know, musicians that came through there. And then also the idiots that came through who, you know, we all put on a pedestal that revealed themselves as doorknobs. So like, it was kind of like really a free for all and quite radical in that everybody's so on TV it makes me sad going back to the building. It's of course changed hands. And now it's the antithesis of what that same space is, the antithesis of what Moses strove to have. It's now all compartmentalized. That one space that was the environment is now home to like 12 different studios, all little boxes there, like rat holes. Mm-hmm.
It felt like at the time, you know, some of that stuff, with you on Much, and I grew up in Ottawa, and there was Tom Green on Rogers Cable Access, who, you know, was similarly radical and kind of felt like the future of media. And I guess with like TikTok and I don't know Vine and all that, it's sort of maybe foresaw that, but it's also very different. It feels, even all those like so-called spontaneous moments on TikTok or Vine or Instagram or whatever it is don't feel spontaneous in the way that, I don't know what.
Yeah, I mean, Tom was a very, I so dig Tom Green. I knew him like in his early, you know, independent public accesses or whatever he was doing in Ottawa that was, you
so
know,
bizarre
parent house or whatever. And he took me out for lunch one time, and like hanging out with Tom Green is like being on the Tom Green show, except yeah. there is no audience. He's just yeah. like that all the time, up to crazy tricks. Yeah. And it was so funny to hang out with him. And he wanted to be on Much Music. I was like, are you crazy? Hire Tom in his heartbeat. He just gaff taped his body to a pole begging for a job here. But the manager at the time, she was too afraid of him. I was like, are you crazy? He's the best. But they were like, no, not controllable enough, you know. So you can see the sort of vying for control as the days went on. I was sort of second gen Much Music DJ. The first gen were, that was a time where it was really, I think there were a lot of drugs and like smoking in the environment, like people would be smoking and stuff. There, that was a sort of hedonistic heydays of like long hair, big hair rock was the origin story of the first gen of Much Music, which I'm sure probably has lots of other stories. I was just sort of like, I was just before punk rock, I guess alternative was considered, like, I guess I fit well, because it was sort of like alternative music was just coming up. It was just, maybe just before or after the year punk broke, and it made sense. But, you know, I was kind of the first stage of gentrification in a weird way. You know, I was still able to, you know, I totally scripted my own self. I was never scripted by anybody else, but the subsequent groups after me were, and then more controlling managers stepped in, and then Moses stepped away, and you can see that with every incremental thing. And it was not some sort of diabolical scheme. It was just like they hired people with less imagination and more kind of risk averse people, and it became kind of a little bit boring, not as interesting, not as fun. I think that TikTok and social media and YouTube has the same spirit. Like a lot of the people are doing their own thing, but what is different is the technology. And as we know, the technology is so key to every evolution of every form. You know, as soon as you could slam on more than one song per side, then we had like LPs, you know? And then, so there are times where, you know, singles are reign supreme when technology is single oriented, and you know, the evolution of vinyl made different forms come alive, and so the technology always dictates aspects of what is going on, because there's the person creating the content, and then there is a delivery system, and so the delivery system. I see a lot of very exciting stuff on TikTok and on Instagram and what have you. But what is different is Much Music. It was monolithic. It was like channel chunking, switching. So it'd be like, you'd be going from like some soap opera to the news to whatever, to what the fuck is this? You know? So it was, it'd be like if a guy on TikTok who's doing some good work had his own channel.
Yeah.
And everybody was watching that guy.
Yeah.
Right now there's just like a saturation of a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it's overwhelming, and you have no choice. But you know, Much Music was the most interesting thing. If you're a kid and you come home from school, you know, you had, it was a Much Music or YTV, and that was really, you know, those are the two most exciting things. And,
yeah.
They were both visually very overstimulating, I found. Yeah, the other, it's interesting also the idea of presenting music in a television format that's very different than the way that people discover music now. Because, of course, for my generation, we discovered music through Much Music and other ways too, but that was one of the main ones. But anyway, when you moved to Toronto to work at Much Music, did you immediately fall in with the music community in Toronto? Was that something that was... I mean, you were working, so, you know.
Yeah, I feel like it was a very seamless slip into the music scene. Yeah. And I've been a part of many music scenes have come and gone since then.
Yeah.
I think the scene that really embraced me, first of all, was like sort of improvisational avant-garde music scene. People like Dale Morningstar, who is a producer who had the gas station. He's produced many, many bands. He was a real freak of a musician. The Dinner Is Ruined. And he really, he was a peer, as well as a CCMC, Michael Snow and John Oswald always invited me to the tier to improvise musically. So I was doing a lot of extended vocal improvisation with those guys. That was sort of entry level one, but then also I was doing my solo album. So I was like very lo-fi self-recorded stuff. And there was, Cindy Beattie of the Chevron, and Justin Paroff, who was a drummer with Broken Social Scene. And I had a trio. Cindy was in a punk band. She was like super heavy bass player who she played in Armed and Hammered, I think. And a trio, I forget her band's name, but it was like two twin brothers who were sort of like, they kind of look like Greasers and Cindy, kind of like Big Ducktail, sort of 50s Elvis style. And Justin, before he was with just Broken Social Scene. We had a kind of pop, weird lo-fi pop band. And then I had my solo work and would just set up and do shows. Carolina Czar from Fifth Column. She was a peer. I feel that she was a peer. And there was a lot of great music. And then there was the whole Metric and Broken Social Scene wave that came, and Feist and Peaches. All those people began like very basic street musicians people who sort of somehow jettisoned and came together to form a community that was sort of catapulted in on a world stage, which is pretty cool to see, because they all kept true to their musical forms without fabricating anything. And then there was, of course, Hidden Cameras and Owen Pallett and Final Fantasy and Phaedra. And like it just keeps morphing into new communities of the same ilk. But ironically, I feel like I have some sort of weird vision, because I've been able to see all these things transpire, but it's incredible to me that scenes don't know the previous scene. And there's even like a 2-year gap between, and they're like, who's Owen Pallett?
Yeah.
You know, or who's Les Mouches?
Yeah.
You know, so it's very interesting to see how short,
I wonder why that is.
I don't know. It's like, I don't know. I mean, there's some really great bands that are going right now that are part of my scene as well. Like I just see, so long as I'm making music, there's always like an independent music scene to be part of that community. It's really nice. I do a lot of work with Dylan Gamble, who's part of Hot Garbage, and he's part of the psych scene in Toronto, which is a very, very exciting music scene. There's a lot of differences too. Like there's the whole sort of DJ Misty Milano and Bambi worlds. And there's a lot of great stuff going on. So I don't know why it seems to be a kind of like, I don't know why, it's because it's not amnesia. It's just like actually a lack of knowing. And a part of me wonders, like, history always repeats itself. And I wonder that, you know, maybe there's this thing in humans that we just don't remember. It's like we have this sort of collective like evaporation of memory, but I do think that you just touched on a couple of interesting things there in terms of scenes. What were you saying? You're saying people are finding the music community seemed to be suffering quite a lot with the pandemic and not being able to do shows and stuff. And yet there has been a real kind of, what I've witnessed in Toronto is a great deal of sort of support and strength among musicians to keep the fire alive and was online, make things when we could. When there was a downtime where there was a brief period where the restrictions were lowered and we all did shows. Well, you know, I was lucky enough to have a show and it was like almost like time collapsed. What I was going to say is, in the period that Adam Litovitz and I were making music with Juge, it was very exciting in Toronto. This would be, 5 years ago, even, where there were underground music, there were like DIY spaces that were the juggernaut. Places like Double Double Land in my neighborhood, I never needed to leave my neighborhood because everything was there. There was performance art, there was music, there was dance. You want to feel like dancing? Just go like through the back lane. And there we are. I mean, that's closed now. So many excellent spaces have closed because, the city was decimated in terms of things happening during the pandemic. And I think there was a lot of real estate jockeying and rebuilding of the city during that time. The city looks completely different in some areas. There were developers really taking advantage of the lockdown and also astronomical rent. When I moved to Toronto, it was very exciting. Toronto was kind of a horrible, boring rock town, but then it was affordable. So a lot of great people moved here, which enlivened the scene tremendously. I worry because there's, people can't congregate if there's no places or only few places to go. I think you were saying that you're seeing students who are really, they're really interested in music and finding a bunch of stuff. And maybe they're not necessarily meeting corporeally online. I mean, in actual shared spaces, but there may be a swing back to more doing that. I think there actually, I see these psych shows in Toronto and there's tons of young people going out. And it also seems like in times of unrest, social unrest, and right now we're all roaming around with PTSD, wandering into this world and going, what? And things are really falling apart in major ways. And that is a great time to be making art. I saw somebody systematically kind of like on a TikTok lecture. They would probably laugh if I thought me calling it a lecture, but he pretty much in 3 minutes underlined the kind of like a very interesting pattern and journey through all these different websites that he would support with screenshots about the convoy in Ottawa and their affiliations. That was fascinating. So people are circuitously navigating the internet, and more than ever, I think people are looking for interesting stuff. So even like, I think there's like Anti-G is a sort of psychotronic website that plays old weird psychedelic movies. And my friend Sarah, I think it's called Anti-G. My friend Sarah goes and they have like screenings, online screenings, and they all watch together. So you're aware, and it's like a lot of young people, and these are very challenging films, young people finding old art movies that are very contrary to the sort of notion of quick, high velocity, kinetic thinking, lack of attention. These, to sit through a 6-hour Bellatar movie requires some, sustenance of mind. And there are some kids that are just like seeking this shit out because it's different from what's overriding and they want to see other stuff. So it'll be interesting because all this crappy stuff that's going on in the world is not going away. And it's going to be coming at us at a higher velocity. I mean, at the same time, in my time, being an artist was really, I choose that with pride. And I think of my broadcasting as a discipline, part of my art practice. And I feel that it is a public service and a responsibility. Now, you look at those articles that say like careers never went to podcasting and being an artist, you know, it's like, I don't know if it really holds the same kind of elevated stature. So, you know,
I mean,
video games are way more interesting than to people than art, you know, video games can be art, but it's just like,
no, absolutely.
E1 just is their E1 capitulated. They don't do, they're not in the music game anymore. They sell toys for Hasbro.
Sorry, who sells games for Hasbro?
E1.
Sorry?
E1.
E1. Right. I had no idea.
Yeah. They're just like, we were just bought by Hasbro, the toy company.
Wow. Real estate jockeying, I'm convinced that some kind of technological advancement has been made in the last couple of years that make it possible to put up a building way faster than they used to. Because it's really alarming how fast they shoot out of the ground. And suddenly these cities are like, we're really just seeing them remade in instantly. It's really
we're witnessing the disappearance of brick mortar. That stuff's not going to be in the future. Those, you know, like on Young Street, they cutely retain some facades of old buildings and then stick this all the weird, like very modern thing around it. All those buildings are going to go. So like, we're actually watching history transform before our eyes, which has happened. Of course, there was something before brick and mortar, but something's going to, it was really sad. I went to, the lockdown has been very exciting for me. It's been very inspiring making stuff. I'm also a filmmaker, and I made one movie that was sort of a documentary, sort of a fiction movie, a quasi-fiction documentary movie called Death and Sickness. It was about living in lockdown. And that was just made on home cameras. I'm an entirely handmade movie, shot on my cell phone and DSLRs, and I edited on iMovie, and miraculously was able to sell to CBC and made some coin to buy a better camera. And I'm making a new movie with Dylan Gamble currently, and just finished a documentary. Where was I thinking? I was going along that trail. So we were wanting to, there was this new movie that we're shooting that I'm now in post-production. It was, again, complete guerrilla filmmaking, tiny crew. There was this one wall that I loved that was part of this medical center. And I was like, oh, fuck, that wall's so great. It has this really 60s couch and this incredible 60s, you know, tiles behind it. And one of the characters waiting in a doctor's, you know, at a hospital. So I go there to like location scout, and it's gone. And it's like the foyer is still there, but it's like been totally remade in this crappy shit that every single medical room in Toronto now has. Like every hospital has this really ugly beige and brown kind of fake wood, quasi fake. Like they're even making fake cement looking gray, boring stuff. And it's aesthetically repulsive. And they've unified that image for all of the spaces. Obviously really cheap materials, kind of looks fancy. Like I think Airbnbs that are fancified also have this sort of kind of stuff. It's I even on an aesthetic level, I try hard. I mean, I could find Vancouver specials, you know, in the 90s, these sort of prefab houses were kind of interesting and had a utility that was admirable in terms of design, and they withstand the time. This shit just looks bad. It's like, wow. They took that other stuff down that looks so good. And now every single, like people are going to hospitals because they're sick. Yeah. They're going to get even sicker if they have to look at the wall or be in that room.
And speaking of Vancouver specials, I was in Vancouver and south on Canby Street, which used to be all lined with Vancouver specials. They've all been expropriated, and it's all glass towers now. It's the Vancouver specials are disappearing. So
those glass towers were ubiquitous to Vancouver, and now they're part of Toronto. And they're not particularly well made. Those glass panels have fallen and nearly impaled people.
Oh my God. That would be a terrible way to go. killed by a building. So before we get to talking about the new record, I don't want to talk too much about the CBC, but I just was hoping you could maybe muse a bit about the difference between television and radio.
Sure. Well, you know, I after I left Much Music, I had a kind of period where I really needed to like rest my brain, because as a result of, we're always affected by our working environments. And I was very kind of, I had a lot of information coming at me, and realized that, you know, when 9/11 happened, I thought it was well into the afternoon until I realized what had happened. I thought everybody was watching a TV show. You know, and I was like, what the fuck? Where am I at? Where is my brain at? How disconnected am I? So I quit Much Music. During that period of time, they were veering toward a more corporate music model, where it would be like, Sir Ken, can you go down to cover the Colgate DJ Challenge?
Yeah.
You'd be like, oh, shit. You know, the writing's on the wall here. And, you know, you can only interview Radiohead so many times, and, you know, that was when there was a lot of sort of prefabricated music coming up with the boy bands and so forth, which some of it is interesting, but as I tried to make it as interesting as possible when I had to go on junkets to cover the Backstreet Boys and stuff, which we did. We'd have like weird hidden cameras and stuff. Really funny. There was some really funny stuff that we did this one where we just focused on the guy who was running the junket. Hilarious. And then, you know, had our secret cameras going that revealed a bunch of other stuff, and just sort of you know, dismantling the junket to begin with and showing how hilarious and absurd it is. So when I quit, I spent like a year just like resting my brain. I think I went to Costa Rica and hung out with sloths to learn how to move a bit slower. But then I needed work again, and the day that I had quit Much Music was the day that I pulled my pants down and mooned the camera. And a couple hours later, I got a call from the CBC offering me a job for another show. And I said, you know, I'm not interested in working right now. But after that year, my depletion of money, they called back. And that was definitely not the opera. It was a show on CBC Radio 1. And at the time, it was sort of an entertainment culture magazine, independent culture magazine, a lot of like reviews and so forth. And so I needed the dough, and I signed on, and the team was based in Winnipeg, and I went to Winnipeg to learn how to make radio. And it was a really huge difference, you know, like on Much Music, I could just, you know, want an image speaks volumes. I just lift my hairy armpit and have a slow zoom into my hairy armpit, and it says everything. How do you do that on radio? Slow zoom into my hairy arm. You can't really write the words down. You know, so it was very much a writer's medium. I had to, I wrote all of my script, and I quickly realized how my writing was disconnected from how I actually speak. So at first I would start writing my scripts, and then I'd read them out loud, and it sounded like terrible, you know, teen diary. Using words like thus and therefore that I would never use, you know, and we don't speak how we write, you know, we don't speak in grammatically grammar and apostrophes and so forth. And so I really had to learn how to write with a sort of in the vernacular, with a kind of conversational syntax, which really helped my film script writing. That really helped. As soon as I learned how to do that, it was just kind of like writing scripts and becoming characters became much easier in writing scripts for movies. But I think the culture of the CBC could not have been further from the rock and roll culture of the, you know, run off the cliff style of Much Music. I mean, my operating system was to run off the cliff. And then sometimes I get pulled back and I'd be castigated and forced to do on-air apologies, which became hilarious after a while at Much Music, like apology number one. And I would be totally upfront. I insulted the, the members of David Bowie's touring band. I have to apologize there. So I always preface it for what the apology was, but I ended up not realizing that the C word was C-NT. To me, it was a feminist power slogan. And when I was interviewing the Red Hot Chili Peppers, I let it go freely because it was on my ring that was made by my friend as a parting gift from Vancouver. Cats, bleeps, and rubber cocks. And so, when I was talking to the Red Hot Chili Peppers, I got in trouble there because I said that. So it's always like, that was my thing. It was kind of funny. I knew I could just go off and then I'd have to do an on-air apology and then it'd be okay. I could move on. Whereas the CBC was
you had to do an on-air apology for using the C word to the Red Hot Chili Peppers. It's so mind-blowing.
They're like, we put the time delay on for the Peppers because we thought they were going to be the ones, but it was for you. And so when I went down the street, it was down to from Much Music to CBC, the public got four blocks, totally different culture. Same street, four blocks down. I felt for the first few years, it was like walking by my ex-lover's house. I had to walk on the other side of the street. And then down to the broadcast center, this very large, kind of tall, Cylon kind of building. The culture is very, very different at the CBC. I really stand by it. Thank God my team was in Winnipeg. The team in the Winnipeg CBC looks more like it is actually in a former used car dealership. So it's a lot cuter and has like a guy that's like, hey, good morning, Sikian. You want to sign you in? Whereas in Toronto, it's just like, you're not Sikian. I'm like, I didn't bring my pass. You're not Sikian. I know I'm Sikian. No, you're not Sikian. What? The different culture and very compartmentalized, and the building breeds intense kind of uptightness and kind of and not by the part of the workers or anyone. I mean, they're just people stuffed in the thing. But I think that there's a high sense of like, we are the public broadcaster. So it's much more corporate, or not corporate, but institutional. Corporate would be what Much Music became. CBC is more like institutional. And so, the culture within institution, I'm not quite sure, but there's a lot of hierarchies. It's not like the privates, where in the privates, if you make something that goes great, you're rewarded. And if you make something that's shit, you probably won't have a show next season. Whereas at the CBC, there's echelons of departments that kind of, I don't know how the management's able to retain their kind of positions without. So it's kind of it's a very strange thing because it's like a very powerful institution, but it doesn't necessarily plays by their own games that are institutionally derived, but it's almost like there's not a lot of checks and balances in this very strange world. It's almost like every manager has their own fiefdom. I think I was there for a decade. Yeah. And it was like, I think it's a classic case of architecture also inhibiting people. It's very, very kind of cold and blocked off. And teams don't necessarily talk to each other. And so everyone's sort of doing their own thing. And they thank God there's good work that can come through there. But there is an overall kind of like, you really get a sense that people are aware of management who are fearful of the next one above. So it feels very a little cold. And it's amazing that, I mean, I think that we did good work because my team was in Winnipeg in the used car dealership. I learned how to make radio in Winnipeg, but then I moved back to Toronto. So I really worked as a satellite member. So a lot of my stuff was like, I could, you know, how everyone's working from home these days. I was a person that I have my Zoom and I make, and I'm also a producer, so I could edit on my laptop. It was very much, you know, I was in constant communication with my virtual team. And so, yeah, so I was, you know, for many years, it was almost a blessing. It was like, oh, go do your little show. Like, I was really on their radar in the public broadcast, the big center. It was, oh, do your little show with your Winnipeg people. And thank goodness I wasn't privy to a lot of the other dynamics. But, you know, we all saw that with what happened with Jean Gomeshi and so forth, just like kind of the culture within the CBC that can be very weird. And they're all regular people, you know, stuffed into this bizarre situation. I'm not really sure what it is. I think things are probably changing radically. They've had to downsize quite a bit. And so they got rid of all of their studios for in the TV side. And now they license, you know, they buy programming made by producers who are probably a bit more on their game. But it means they can't own the stuff, but they can license it. And then they have some in-house that they produce. And I mean, I don't watch a whole ton of TV, but it seems like they're, I think with Gem, I mean, Gem bought Death and Sickness. I couldn't believe it. I'm just like, wow. Yeah, CBC Gem is a streaming platform. So they buy a lot of programming as well. So you can watch TV shows and stuff. It's all free, but you have to sit through the ads and stuff. And so that's a model where they're buying programming. And then also, you know, the guy that bought mine, though, he moved to TikTok. I was just like, what? It was like, I sent him the first chapter of Death and Sickness. And I'm like, this is what I'm up to. And he's like, this is great. He's like, obviously it's an art movie, so make it. And I have no notes. I'm not going to give you any notes. You have complete control. I'll purchase it from you at the end. I was like, what the fuck? That never happens at CBC. And I was so grateful for that because that got me through the pandemic. But he's gone now. So I hope that they have other innovators there. So the TV, at the same time, you know, I think it was a part of their survival to, I think it's a good idea to turn to producers in Canada and see what they're making. At the same time, there's ups and downsides to it as well. I know a lot of the workforce in the radio side is being depleted. You know, when I started to make podcasts and they were like, okay, we want to shift you over to the digital innovation wing. This is where the hottest stuff is going out. This is going to be great. This is like the podcast, the 24-hour sleepover podcast that I made was in that under that thing. The only thing is, again, everyone's freelance and there are no, you're going to lose your dental. and, you know, so they're, you know, a lot of great stuff is happening in the digital wing, but all these people are on short-term contracts and they don't have necessarily coverage of these things.
And that was probably,
as I say to you, as I have a tooth that is really in my mouth.
I was going
to
say, everyone's making podcasts, but they have fat cheeks and swollen teeth. Well, that's fascinating. Let's talk about Juge 2. And great record. I really like it. I didn't expect it to be so electronic sounding, and that's amazing. But I wanted you, I mean, obviously your collaborator, Adam Ludovitz, passed away halfway through making the record, which is a horrible thing to have happen. But maybe tell us first off just who Adam Ludovitz is, because there may be listeners that have no idea.
Yeah, Adam Ludovitz is my dear friend and partner for many years, collaborator, creative collaborator and mischief maker, wonderful human being. He is looking at me right now because there's a photo of him on the wall. We used to go to the community center and go swimming. and do laps and stuff. And he would invariably, because I'm a fish, he would end swimming before me, but he loved to meditate. And there was this one hallway in the basement of the community center that had a lot of like air drafts and tubes and like kind of industrial sounds. And he loved just sitting on this blue chair and meditating. And I would come out after, after my swim and meet him outside, and he'd be sitting there on his chair. Very, very beautiful writer and poet and thinker, very playful. And when we found each other, we were immediately kindred spirits in our love of play. And really a wonderful, wonderful person. We made lots of things together, dance narratives and music, you name it. And that was just a quality of our creative relationship that spilled off into our private lives. And so Adam was very, very huge part of my life, my family. After 12 years of being together, we began to diverge. He wanted to pursue other things that he was doing things in our kind of our romantic relation sort of culminated, and we ended up going apart. But also after, it was a difficult period of not being together for both of us, but then we did end up coming back together as very always, always, always very good friends. And we were making this album together. It was about 80% done. Adam was pursuing, he was scoring a Netflix series with Anna Kabazian, and up to his own work, a journalist work and so forth. He was living, we were no longer living together, but a few years prior to his passing, he became more anxious about the state of the world and the state of his life, not knowing exactly where he was going to put his creative energies. It's something that a lot of young people feel, a lot of young men in particular, trying to figure out what they were built for in this world. Adam was definitely an artist, and he felt it very, he couldn't see himself sort of fitting into, you know, becoming a robot doing kind of work that his heart was not into. So it was really hard for him to find that path forward. But it was something that many, many people wrestle with. I was away in Los Angeles away at the time and in Vancouver when he had decided, he emailed me or texted me, and he had decided that he wanted to try anti-anxiety medication. And he went to CAMH, which is a local mental health facility. And within a 20-minute diagnosis, two doctors who did not know his past history prescribed him a concoction of various drugs that some people have these drugs and they can navigate well and the drugs can help them. Some people have a biochemistry that does not suit the drugs at all. And it was pretty clear from the get-go when Adam had a very strong psychological response to them, not well. I mean, he was very discombobulated, and these drugs had a very bad repercussion to his mind. He was shunted back to his family doctor, who did not talk to the previous doctors. There was no consistency in the treatment. And the first doctors had said he should not be on a particular medication, and that other doctor put him on the one that was, so it was like a big mess of, and I only realized this afterwards, because I was able to piece together this medical timeline after his passing. But I did not realize, I mean, to what extent the sort of normal sphere of anxiety and depression, not normal, I mean, it's not a normal thing to have, although it is normalized because most everybody has them, where that met the pharmaceutical drugs and a violent response that, a deep and unsettling response that his biochemistry had, and then also being kind of without the consistency of the doctors talking to him. He only trusted his doctors. And unfortunately, that led to an addiction to a particular drug and that had very low yielding advantages for him. It actually became a portal to just incredible pain. And he became addicted to the drugs, and they're having a worse and worse effect upon him. And he was having a hard time hanging onto his mind. In the week before he passed, we were in constant communication, texting, but I was involved in the development of a play, and I wasn't able to see him. And these were the critical days in which he was not able to sleep for 10 days in a row. And that kind of thing will make anybody crazy. And I saw him the day before he passed, and he was not well, obviously having a hard time keeping track of his thoughts and so forth. And, you know, we had planned to meet the next day. When he didn't show up, I knew something had happened, because he was always there. He was always on time. Whenever we decided to meet up, we were there for each other. And I knew right away that something was wrong. And I think at some point between the time that I saw him and the time the next day, he decided to take his life. And he did so with, he did so with certainty. And I can only understand through, like, I was able to piece together his timeline, and base friends would came to me with information that they had, and it illuminated a portrait of a person who kept, Adam, who kept much of this to himself. It must have been very scary and troubling, this period of time. And, he's a very beautiful, open, playful, deep, heavy, wonderful person whose mind was very, very intense. I've seen that, another person who was on the same drug, Jordan Peterson, also, I disagree with his politics, but obviously a person who thinks a lot. I think there's some brain chemistries that we'd be well to kind of investigate. The problem is these drugs are, there is no desire to incentive to understand them, because they're very cheap drugs. So there's they're everywhere. There's no incentive, because nobody can make money by, you know, bringing attention to what has happened. But more and more people, I mean, when I spoke out about this, when I discovered this, Adam was trying to tell me too. He was like, "Sukian, I think these drugs are changing my brain." At the time, I was like, "No, you're going to be okay." I was like the cheerleader. And I regret that so much, not hearing him closer. And, since October 2020 or October 2021, the PAM drugs that have been around forever now must come in Canada with a warning that says may cause suicidal ideation. And it's only until last year that now they have the warning. So people are just getting doled out in 20 minutes. Boom. You got it. And then people are, thank God I've got this thing. Boop, pop, 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 pop. And then suddenly their bodies are hooked to it. And they're very bad. Like it is a addiction. It is no like no other. Jordan Peterson, he also felt he could only get treatment by going overseas. He's a wealthy guy. To go to overseas to get treatment, because there is no treatment facility in Canada for this. And he still suffers from the withdrawal symptoms and so forth. So, I mean, So Adam and I were making this album. It was about 80% done when he had to diverge his energies to do the scoring for the TV series. And then he passed, we love this music so much. I really wanted to finish the album with Steve Charlie, who mixed it. And Steve lost his mom in that year as well. So there was a lot of loss in that year. And this is just the year before the pandemic. And so it was very crucial for me, first of all, to to understand what had happened with Adam by piecing together his medical timeline. But after that was, you know, I put that together for the Toronto Ontario surgeons. There's this sort of board, and it was important for me to sort of spell it out to them so that the doctors involved could understand and see what their actions or inactions had led to or contributed to. I don't blame anyone, but I think it's very helpful for, you know, doctors to understand how these systems also entrap us. So now, you know, it was very important for me to preserve Adam's work, his poetry, his writing. I have a website, sookianlee.com, and he has a chapter, a section that features his journalistic writing and his essay writing and his thought. And he's also prolific, beautiful. When we separated, he really dove into making art, and he really went into his visual art in such a fantastic way. So all of that work is available on his Instagram profile, which is astonishing artwork, beautiful artwork. And then, of course, to complete this music, of which I'm so happy to share, because I feel that I can hear him in his presence. In the, his spirit is really inscribed in his words, in his music, in all of his creation, and in this work that we did together. So it's really a pleasure for me to play these songs for people.
Yeah. So is when you're out on the road, you're going to be playing songs from the record?
Yeah, for sure. Cool. Yeah. Right so on. There was a tiny respite where restrictions were down, and I knew that I wanted to share this music, and I played one show and I was able to do it. I had a candle there for Adam.
Yeah.
And then played the songs. So it's me, you know, we can do these things too. Just give me a laptop, give me a microphone, and I can do it.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm going to be doing. I'm playing songs from the Juge 2 album in Ottawa and Montreal.
Cool. I always try to ask people about making records, because it's something that I'm really into, and I love hearing people talk about doing it. When you and Adam started making this record, do you work in studios? Do you have a home studio?
Yeah, no. Like,
do you like to work in the day? Do you like to work at night?
When I moved to Toronto, that was like during the lo-fi revolution, and that's when I was just like four track, or just like I rented a 16 channel board and ADAT and just learned the gear and recorded my solo albums that way. It was like way better with Bob's Your Uncle. We were a good band, but made worse in the studio, because it would be like bands would be like, okay, we're gonna hit the big time and go into a big studio with a producer who will tell us what to do and shape our sound, and it'll cost a lot, you know. So I kind of realized, working with Bob's Your Uncle, I was never really satisfied with any of our recordings. There are a couple songs that I really love, but as a whole album, I can stand by my solo work as a full entity a bit more. With Bob's Your Uncle, we are more like an extended family, and I love performing with them, and I stand by our shows. But in terms of, I think we were too quick to acquiesce to the big studio. We made one 8-track album that was great, that we did ourselves, but then we sort of studio mentality, and I don't think it served our music well. So I learned, that was a big music lesson for me to learn. And so when I moved to Toronto, it was like, oh, it says my internet connection is unstable. Can you hear me? Okay. Okay, great. The lo-fi revolution really put the technology into the hands of creators, and was very good. With Adam and I, we've never been in a studio. We always recorded on our own devices. So, when you have basic software, you know, you can make, you get an interface, a good computer. You don't even need a good computer, but it's absolutely possible. We made all the albums right here. We made four albums together, two film scores, two movie scores from my films, and two Juge albums right in this space. And you know, when you're using electronic gear, a lot of it is just dial right into this thing. We described a lot, our music is sort of a dirt and bone, where we would incorporate technology, but also go and pick up a bag of dirt, you know, and acoustic instruments and sounds or things we find hit. Neither of us was virtuosic, but we did have a sense of melody and intelligence, so we could, you know, put things together. And have all the time in the world. And I always compared our processes like gardeners, you know, all the time in the world to think about it, place it, you know, reconsider it, remove it, add, you know, it's a beautiful way to make music and make art. And I'm making movies with Dylan Gamble with the same spirit now. Like, to me, that's mind blowing. You know, yeah. We've been told that you can only make a movie with a huge crew.
Yeah.
Now it's a casting crew of two people. We're recording sound and taping and playing multiple roles. In this new movie, we're doing this crazy movie of Death and Sickness was a work of, it was based upon our lives, but this is all completely fiction. Playing multiple roles in the same scene. And this one, we've been able to cast our, go a little wider. We have friends that are playing parts. And again, very, very, very down to earth style. One of the actors is a guy that we met who was delivering Uber Eats to my neighbor on Christmas a year ago. Khan, who's from Bangladesh and super smart and a beautiful artist and a musician. And we struck up a great convo and ended up hanging out with him on Christmas Eve. And then he became friends and I'm like, hey, Khan, I've got the scene. You want to be an actor? He showed up and there he was the other day. He's in the movie. And then, you know, he suddenly grabbed a light and then suddenly he was our lighting guy. So like that kind of feeling, you know, you can make really, really good stuff, you know, and, you know, we're not compromising on the sound or picture. I was able to buy a Sony FX3 camera, which is like 4K, beautiful, beautiful image. With wicked autofocus. When you're having to shoot yourself, you can rest assured you're in focus. Well, we just wrapped the actual acting part, and now it's gonna now we're on the gargantuan side of post production. So that'll be me editing and scoring and Dylan scoring. And working on that. But we just also, for the Wavelength Music Series, this has been very exciting. They have a winter festival speaker series. And Buffy St. Marie, Beverly Copeland, Casey Mejia, Maylee Todd, and myself, we were invited to do a speaker series to the theme of community care. And I said to them, well, I just did a live performance of Songs by Adam and I. So maybe how's about Dylan and I can make a film instead. We'll just make a film instead of doing a speaking thing. We'll make a film. And so we've been in the last month or so working on that. And that's very exciting. It's a sort of a very personal video essay, very playful, kind of playful experimental documentary. It's called Who Cares? And it really investigates and explores and sometimes challenges the idea of care. You know, what the fuck does it mean to care? What is community care? What does that mean to you? What is it? How do I even take care of myself? My tooth is falling out of my mouth right now. You know, so it raises a lot of questions. So that is going to be airing online, premiering on March 16th at 7 p.m. Yeah, it's the Wavelength Winter Festival Speaker Series. And they have a great website. I saw Maylee Todd's virtual presentation last night. And ours is going to be, our documentary is going to be, it's like a 40-minute documentary. And it's pretty much a follow-up to Death and Sickness. And it pretty much is like, how do we make these tender footsteps into this new world that we're coming out of post-pandemic.
So maybe just tell us what we can expect at the show here in Montreal on the 18th at the Diving Bell Social Club.
Okay, so Montreal, you know, I haven't played there since I was with Bob's Runkle. I have such great memories of Montreal. They're great fried food. Excellent submarine sandwiches, and they grill the buns, which I really appreciate. Great culture. Whenever I played there, I played at Fufun Electrique. I opened for Nick Cave at the Spectrum. I played at a place on Saint Laurent upstairs. Whenever we would go there, all these freaks would come out and dance their buns off. And just like the level of artistry and intellectual discourse and creativity and appreciation was, and beauty, very high in Montreal. So I love that space. So I really wanted to put together a special show. And so Benjamin Camino is a dancer that he's a gorgeous dancer. And Ben and I and Adam created a work called How Can I Forget? A few years back, it was a duet danced by Benjamin and myself. And he really has a visceral, amazing quality as a dancer. He performs with people like Marie Chouinard in Quebec and Beautiful Mover. And so Ben is opening with a solo set. He is dancing and also utilizing large masses of paper in a kind of sound collage or sound piece with paper and movement of body. And everybody just come to the show to see Ben alone will blow your mind. And I wanted to seek out a great musician from Montreal. I wasn't really keyed into who's going, but then, you know, one person led to the other, you know, what led to the other led me to Johnny Boyd, who is a producer and musician and performs music in all kinds of manners and shape-shifting manners. He's with the Constellation Gang. We had three very exciting artists on the bill, each contributing a solo. I really wanted to sort of meet Montreal with what we've got. And give them something that they have given me in terms of wonderful art and thinking and culture.
Before we finish, maybe you could tell us about the playlist we're about to listen to.
I was lucky enough to inherit Adam's Spotify account. And it's amazing space of to see his, he loved music. And he had a far-reaching love of music, all the kinds of music. He highlighted his favorite albums. And, I don't touch it. I just like, I'm so happy to be able to have his albums there. And all of the music is derived from his favorited albums. And these go span the gamut. He's so influenced by hip hop music and music, frankly, from all over the world. And this playlist, I call music from his favorite albums, and you'll just get a sense of when I hear the music, I go, oh my God, this is so much. You can hear our the influence in our sound, in the contribution that Adam made to the work of Juge and our music. You can really kind of hear a very dexterity and love of music of all kinds, but then something that guides and connects all of them is a very special music of substance and spirit. And so I share this with you with a great deal of pleasure.
Thanks again to Sukyin for taking the time to speak to us. Once again, the show is this coming Friday, March 18th, at Social Bell Diving Club on Santa Ana Boulevard. And that's with Johnny Boyd and Benjamin Camino. And Sukyin's film, Who Cares, with Dylan Gamble, is airing on the 16th. So that's Wednesday. You can find that at Wavelength Toronto. So that's wavelengthmusic.ca for their Winter Festival speaker series. And now we're going to listen to a playlist curated by Adam Lidovitz. Rest in peace. Thank you for listening.